This Hour of the Jason Rand Show brought to you by You Build It. There is a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So, let's find out what's trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
In a column in today's Seattle Times, Matt Calkins took on the Iron Front flag being waved at Sounders games. And in this piece, it's pretty shocking how some Antifa supporters openly are saying that, yeah, violence is okay to use when going after political opponents. One supporter who took that position, a professor at Pacific Lutheran. It's a story that we've covered pretty extensively on the show, so it's always good to see another member of the media actually finding out what we found out. Joining me to discuss the column is Matt Calkins. Matt, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, it's great to be on. Thanks, Jason.
So what prompted you to write this column?
Well, when I saw the national headlines for this story a few weeks ago with the silent protest in Portland and just all the controversy surrounding the Iron Front flag and how MLS said it was being co-opted by Antifa, which was why they were not letting the symbol into stadiums, I wanted to get another perspective on it because I had a feeling that there were people who probably weren't so on board with the whole Iron Front thing, but I also wanted to see if there truly was a connection between the anti-fascist, anti-racist, Always Seattle crowd and Antifa. So I went out to the Sounders game on September 1st, the day they played the Galaxy, and I walked with the fans through the march to the match, and then I tried to get various leaders of the ECS to talk to me. And as you probably know, they don't like the media very much.
So and ECS, by the way, ECS, Emerald City Supporters, this is a local independent fan club that supports the Sounders.
Yeah, thank you. And most of them, or all of them, didn't want to talk to me. And then finally, I went up to this guy named Troy Storfell and his son, Epson, and I just started asking them questions about, you know, what they thought of the whole controversy. And Troy told me that MLS had to be prepared to lose its most zealous supporters if it didn't rescind the Iron Front ban. But then I said, well, what about Antifa co-opting it? And he said, I say hell yes to that. And I said, well, what about them using violence? He's like, violence against fascists. And I said, well, what about this reporter, Andy No, who's just a journalist and getting milkshakes thrown at him and beaten up? He goes, he's no journalist. I don't have a problem with it. I go, and he says, there are people starving at the border, so if one fascist gets a milkshake thrown at him, I go, well, Andy was beaten up. And he goes, and beaten up. I don't have a problem with it. So I don't know if he represents all of ECS, but nobody else would talk to me, and I found those statements pretty alarming.
And who is Troy Storfell, by the way?
He is the professor at Pacific Lutheran. he teaches Nordic studies, I want to say, and he volunteered that information. So, yeah, some kids are being taught by that guy. So,
which is alarming, and it points to the concerns a lot of people, myself included, have about Antifa, is that they decide who is going to be deemed a fascist, who is worthy of getting a beat down, and their general definition of folks who are anti-fascist seem not just to be, you know, white supremacists, but all conservatives, all Republicans, all police officers.
Right, and that's the thing. And as I mentioned in the article, these guys have clashed with some truly awful people.
Yes.
The white supremacists in Charlottesville, I think, is the most prominent example. But as you said, I say they go around fighting fascism with their own dictionary. And their dictionary says that fascist is anybody that we disagree with. So they go after cops. They go after conservatives. They don't try to talk with them. They just decide they don't like them. And if they have to resort to violence, they do. So that's what's scary about them is, in my opinion, is that, you know, they just kind of pick and choose who they don't like for the most part. And I don't want to use sweeping generalizations. There might be some people in there who are very well-intended. I don't see a lot of articulate people from Antifa, like, you know, explaining their point and what they're trying to do, that's something that I think a lot of people just don't know about. When I was, you know, kind of workshopping this story with various coworkers, they were telling me, yeah, I just don't know that much about Antifa, and I don't know if that's a media problem or what it is, but I think it's important that more people do know.
Just joining us, we're talking with Matt Calkins, a sports columnist over at the Seattle Times. His piece sort of looked at both sides of the Iron Front flag and how it's been used by the Sounders fans and also MLS in general. You know, I'm looking at some of the tweets in response to your story. I'm sure you have as well. What's the reaction been like, other than being called a complete disgrace?
That's just another day in the office, really. But you know, there have been three mediums really for feedback. The first one's Twitter, which has just totally annihilated me. I expected that from the very beginning. Just a lot of people saying this is a garbage article, or why would you even credit Andy Ngo as a journalist, whatnot. And that's been pretty much what's been going on Twitter. But the comment section has been, for the most part, very supportive. And the most liked comments in the comment section have been, thanks for taking this on, or I'm scared to go to Sounders games, yep. Or, you know, I'm glad finally somebody said it. And the third medium has been emails, which has been overwhelmingly positive. A lot of people just saying, thanks for writing this. I've been thinking the same thing. And I think this speaks to how scared people are to publicly praise a story like that for fear of getting backlash. One of the guys I quoted in the article, named Mike McDonald, I actually had to cut a few things just for space reasons. This actually wasn't in the article. It was in the original version, but I had to trim a few things. He's a guy that's against the Iron Front symbol at Sounders games, and he said that he gets called a fascist just for questioning the Emerald City supporters. And I totally believe him when he says that. It's easy to say, you know, we're anti-fascist, but I think people who look closely know that it can mean a little bit more than what's on the surface.
Well, and the irony of the thing is, when we talk about fascism and fascistic, principles,
right.
One thing that fascists do is try to stop the opposition from organizing and speaking. And yes,
right.
there is a clear case of instances of white supremacy in this country that needs to be stomped out, including a story we covered earlier today on the show in Homish. That's not what this is about. They're going way beyond that. I mean, I'm a gay Jew, and ECS members called me a white supremacist Nazi because I dared to say that Antifa violence is wrong. Violence is wrong, period.
Exactly. Yes, there is white supremacy in this country. There's no one's denying that. And, you know, if I see a white supremacist, I'm going to have a huge problem with him, as I think you would too, and 99.9% of the country would. But it is funny how, you know, a lot of the people that Antifa says to be protecting, you know, the marginalized people, they say, whether it's their sexual orientation, or whether it's their gender, whether it's their race, how quickly that goes out the window if you disagree with what they said. They don't care if you're black anymore. They don't care if you're gay anymore or a woman. You disagree with us, you're not on our team anymore.
And one thing that you mentioned in the story, and really part of the point of the column, is to suggest that people are leaving either ECS, or they're leaving the Sounders, or becoming less interested in the sport as a result of all of this. You talk specifically to one. I've spoken to quite a few who have either decided to leave ECS or are talking about leaving ECS. I've spoken to some folks who aren't going to games anymore. And ultimately, that does a disservice to the sport by sort of getting too involved in politics.
I agree, and I don't know how many people it is. You know, maybe it is just the 20 or 30 people that we talk to, and this is not going to have any sort of significant dent in their attendance. I'm not going to pretend to know. I do know there are some people, and I do know that this has the potential to turn off people down the road. You know, one thing I say, you know, this is a benefit versus cost thing. I don't think there's any, like, budding fascist that's going to look up at these signs, you know, and go, oh my God, they're so right, and change their ways. But I think there are a lot of people who could see those signs and are suddenly repelled. So, you know, my whole thing is, if these guys don't go to games because of the signs, because there's a ban on their signs, I don't know how big of fans they really are in the first place. And I don't think that's something that they're going to get a lot of sympathy for down the road. One or two protests, maybe. But if they just boycott games in the name of the sign, people are going to go, whatever, dude. Like, this is just a game. Take your politics somewhere else.
And the last thing, just because I know that in your research, I'm assuming you reached out to the Sounders. They are kind of in a difficult position here, where there's no doubt that the Sounders as an organization is a progressive one. There's just no doubt about that. And at the same time, you've got a lot of people, myself included, who are like, shouldn't politics just completely stay out of this? And they need to try to do whatever they can, to your point of costs and benefits, like try to make everybody happy. And ultimately, that's an impossible task.
It really is. It's easy to criticize the Sounders and MLS in this situation. It really is. But they are in a difficult spot trying to balance, you know, their keeping their most zealous fans happy and trying to keep politics out of sports. I think there is a parallel between what's going on between MLS and the Iron Front thing and the NBA in China, where they're going, all right, yeah, we want to support free speech and we want to recognize that there are human rights violations going on in China, but at the same time, that's a huge part of our business. It's easy for us to criticize and just go, oh, the NBA doesn't care about, you know, freedom, but it's more complicated than that. So I'm not going to give the founders a pass in this or yeah. MLS. I think they have to, you know, give a lot of thought to it. But it's a tough spot, and I think realistic people have to acknowledge that.
The article is up right now at the Seattle Times website, seattletimes.com. And, of course, we tweeted it out, which, of course, is going to inspire a whole bunch of Sounders fans who support Antifa to call us two white supremacists talking about Antifa issues, which, of course, is nonsense. Matt Calkins, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
I look forward to knowing what life is like being you. I think I just stepped into that.
There's a lot of crying and a lot of self-loathing. You're listening to the Jason Rant Show. By the way, we did just get an email from Troy Storfeld, the professor and director of Native American and Indigenous Studies program over at PLU, because we did just talk about him in that segment with Matt. We invited the professor on the show. He said, thank you for your email. Given the way I was creatively quoted and misframed in the newspaper article, I'm uncomfortable making further statements to the media. I'm pretty sure that the audio of his interview was on tape. It was recorded by Matt. So we'll look into that to see if there was anything that was creatively quoted.
Detective Ranch on the case.
Okay, it's Ranch, not Ranch. I don't even like ranch. If I'm going to go with the sauce, it's honey mustard. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at the movies?
It's Friday. You know what that means? It means I get to talk movies thanks to our wonderful sponsor, Alpine Specialty Cleaning at alpineclean.com. The big movie weekend release is Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. And in this sequel to the Disney hit Angelina Jolie's Maleficent, an unfairly maligned witch, she faces the prospect of her goddaughter, Aurora, marrying the prince of a nearby kingdom, and she is not happy.
Mistress, what? I have a little bit of news.
Well, on with it.
It's nothing of any real consequence, and it's certainly no reason to overreact. It's just that Prince Philip has,
disappeared.
No, Philip has...
Yellow fever? No, wait. Leprosy.
No, Mrs. Prince Philip has asked Aurora... It should become his...
Don't ruin my morning.
But she relents. She agrees to meet with the prince's family, only to realize his mother, the queen, she's up to no good.
You have done an admirable job going against your own nature to raise this child. But now she will finally get the love of a real mother. Tonight, I consider Aurora...
So I admit seeing Maleficent on IMAX probably made it a little bit more exciting, but I loved this movie. I found it inventive, exciting, intriguing, and fun. And I am in the minority on Rotten Tomatoes. I actually really like this. Yes, it is, in fact, absolutely gorgeous to look at with costumes and scenery that I think is pretty awe-inspiring. And usually when people say that, they mean the storyline isn't good. But I think Jolie plays the character incredibly well, and I enjoyed the story. She has a knowing level of evil where she doesn't just feel comfortable admitting she has a little bit of a heart, and you can see it in her eyes and the smirk she has in so many scenes. It is a subtle performance you generally don't get in fairy tales. Yes, it is true that you can tell where the movie's story is going to go. You look at the trailer and you pretty much know how it's going to end to a point. However, despite not having too many twists and turns, the way they tell the story, I found it effective. And yes, I thought it was a little emotional. And of note, for those of you who've got kids, because this is a Disney fairy tale that's rated PG, there were a lot of kids in the screening. Probably the youngest was 9 years old, the oldest maybe 13. And that's about as young as I'd go, 9 years old. They seemed all entertained. They weren't making noises. They weren't fussing around. And it's a movie that they're going to like, but more importantly for you, it's a movie you will like as an adult. I really, really enjoyed Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, It's out right now, and I do recommend it. Tell me what movie you're going to see this weekend. Text me, 1-800-465-877. Are you going to see Maleficent, or are you going to go with Zombieland Part 2? 1-800-465-8770. Now, let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Big picture.
Employees in some Seattle companies are using virtual reality to prepare for an active shooting at work if, God forbid, that were to happen.
Employers want to provide training to their employees to just help them feel a little bit more empowered to do something.
So the training uses a virtual reality headset. It was created by a company called Pixvana, in which that COO Rachel Landman works. It teaches users how to survey a room during an active shooting situation. Here's one of the developers talking with Cairo 7 TV.
One of the balances that we had to go through was playing with how real we wanted to make it, how scary, because active shooter, it's really scary.
So it's not just about surveying a room, but it's also about how to find ways to escape, how to barricade yourself, how to fight back if that's necessary. There was a company on Capitol Hill called The Riveter that did some training and used this company. Their spokesperson, Sheena Kamagong, says it's good for adults to practice.
If our young kids are learning how to drill in their schools, how to be prepared, we should also be doing that in our work. It's just good to kind of make sure that we're aware that this can happen anywhere at any time.
So Paul Allen's company, Vulcan, they also went through the program to train their employees. And King County Sheriff's Sergeant Ryan Abbott says, yeah, training like this is a good idea.
Anything extra that people can do to educate themselves and be ready for a situation like that, and that's something that people need to know about, and they can't just be sitting waiting.
And look, generally I agree with that. I've got some concerns when we do things like this, only in that I don't want people to freak out so much that they think that this is likely. It can happen. It 100% can happen. We obviously have seen it happen, but it is incredibly rare. And when you go ahead and push this kind of training on people, I do think it has an unintended consequence of not just getting people to feel prepared, but people getting to feel paranoid. And I don't know what we can do to kind of get to the point where you're prepared without feeling paranoid, because I do think it's human nature to go through something like this and then all of a sudden start looking around and looking at your own situations and being suspicious of people who are walking by. I don't know the right way to do it. I also wonder if it's the right move to put it into a VR headset. Now, maybe that actually makes it a little bit less consequential in the anxiety department. Because I was thinking about the story of, well, it makes it seem like a video game. And that, I think, takes away, even if it's incredibly real, as the developer said, as they were trying to figure out how real they're going to make it, it does sort of lessen the impact of it in my head, at least, that, okay, it's still a video game. And maybe that's what makes you not as anxious afterwards, because you experience it as a video game and you know that it's fake. And again, it's not a video game, but that's probably how the brain would take it. Am I crazy?
No.
If we put you through this kind of testing or this kind of seminar, wouldn't you immediately start looking around the office and be like, okay, what if someone comes in? Because I'm assuming we're as much of a target, if not more, than the Riveter or Vulcan. Because we got a lot of, not me, of course, but we got a lot of loudmouths in our studios here, right?
Oh, yeah, not
who,
you.
Definitely sure. Not me, who take controversial positions on a whole host of things. And look, I've received death threats before. We had one last year that we had to get prosecuted. I had to go through the courts. It was a big pain in the backside to go through that process. And I was incredibly paranoid for a bit because the guy who, this was actually 2 years ago now, the guy who did it made it sound like he was going to shoot me. And they prosecuted and he ended up settling. But, you know, I was paranoid at that point. And that was in a real life situation. And so if you put me now through this kind of stuff, it's just compounding that kind of anxiety that I have, and I don't know if I want to go through with that. I generally know, and I think most people know, in most situations, how to at least get out of a building. It's good to tell people again here and there, but I don't know if I like the VR idea. Let me know. Send me a text. Let me know how you guys feel. 1-800-465-8770. Welcome Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. We've been hearing more and more complaints about the cost of living in Shoreline, that it's becoming unaffordable for a whole bunch of folks. And for those who stay, they're not necessarily happy with the lack of business development. It's got me interested a lot more in exploring the upcoming Shoreline City Council races since ballots right now are in the mail. Earlier in the week, we spoke to the challenger for position number two, Vivian Kolika. Now the incumbent joins us, attorney Keith Scully. Keith, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Jason, and I really appreciate you reaching out to Shoreline to give us some coverage. Sometimes it seems like Seattle sucks up all the media attention. It's great to see Shoreline getting some, too.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's one of those issues that I hear from everybody I talk to outside of Seattle, which is like, you know, we're impacted by a whole bunch of things that are happening around the state just as much as Seattle. Pay attention to us. And, you know, one of the things that I heard from a couple people now, just complaints in a general sense of one aspect of living in Shoreline is that there's just not many places to go to eat. And they say, hey, gotta go outside of the district for some of the entertainment venues. And I'm wondering if you agree with the complaint of business development there and what's being done about it.
So I hear that too a lot, and I absolutely share that sentiment. Everybody wants to be able to walk to amazing restaurants and coffee shops, and it's something that we think about and put a lot of work into making happen. We've done a bunch of panels with restaurant people and small business owners and everybody else to ask them, why isn't there more business in Shoreline? And we've heard a variety of answers, but the one we hear the most is Shoreline doesn't really have dense, walkable urban environments, which is what businesses like that need to survive. So you look at downtown Edmonds, you've got a real draw there. Shoreline doesn't have that yet. And so what we've done to try and fix that is concentrate development around the light rail stations, which will hopefully get people living in one place and create the density that businesses need in order to start and thrive.
Is the goal to, especially with Sound Transit coming, to get people less reliant on cars?
That's part of the goal. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to do that. Business development is a big part of it. Less car reliance is another big part of it. Although I fought hard and my fellow council members joined me in making sure we got a parking garage at the light rail station, because a carless future, if that happens, great. But if that happens, that's not going to be for another 20 or 30 years, if at all. And we've recognized that although that's a viable goal, we also need to confront the reality that most people who live in Shoreline have a car and are going to continue having a car for the time, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Well, what I've heard from doing just some of the research on you, you know, part of the things that a lot of people will give you credit for is fighting on behalf of the environment, in particular, increasing protections for trees, and related to the Sound Transit stuff. Obviously, Sound Transit had to cut down a whole bunch of trees to make way for their expansion. From your perspective, obviously, you want to have light rail service Shoreline, but you also want to protect the trees and the environment. So how do you justify cutting down those trees?
So it's a balancing thing between sort of regional environmental goals. Mm-hmm. Regional environmental goals are, let's get mass transit, let's get people living in areas where they don't have to drive for a really long way, and let's get people living in cities so we don't have to convert forest land or farmland. But there's the competing goal, which is let's make our cities livable. And part of making them livable is preserving at least some of our existing trees. And striking that balance between letting development happen, letting business occur, and getting folks in the cities, and yet not clear-cutting everything, that's a tough one. And I'm not sure we've got it 100% right, but it's certainly my goal to keep those two things in mind.
But you did, correct me if I'm wrong, you do support the cutting of the trees in this way because it serves some of the needs of Shoreline in the long term.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, so we knew from the start that there was going to be some significant tree loss from Sound Transit, and that for me was a no-brainer. I mean, I commute from Shoreline to Belltown every day, so we need better ways to get to our jobs, and that includes some tree loss, and I absolutely knew that and supported it going in.
Just joining me, we're talking with attorney Keith Scully. He is the Shoreline City Council member for position number two. He's up for re-election. Ballots right now are in the mail. You know, you make the point that you go from Shoreline to the city of Seattle for work every day. Obviously, you've seen the homelessness crisis in Seattle and especially in Belltown. You've backed a regional approach to homelessness. How do you think the problems impacted Shoreline, and what does a regional approach actually look like when it comes to Shoreline?
So that's a big question. I'll try and answer it succinctly. Let me start with the regional approach. I back a regional approach in concept, And what I've been working on for the last year is finding a way to make services which are provided in Seattle and King County mostly, but also throughout the region, more accountable and effective. There's a ton of red tape, and there's a ton of different entities funding and setting standards, and there's really not a central place where you can go to make sure these programs are working and that tax money is being spent wisely. So I said I support it conceptually, and I do. The existing plan has a troubling component to it, which is an oversight body that is appointed with then a layer on top of that of elected oversight, but not a lot of direct control by elected officials. And anytime you've got tax money, in my view, you've got to have an elected official holding the ultimate authority for that, because we can get fired by the voters, and you shouldn't have your tax money being spent by someone you can't fire.
Well, and look, it's also going to be Seattle-centric, and that, I think, is a problem for anyone outside of Seattle.
Yeah, so yeah, and it, yes, and that's a double-edged sword, right? I mean, we absolutely want to make sure that we get services in Shoreline. We want to make sure that Shoreline's tax money is spent in Shoreline, and we want to make sure that our King County money, which is was paid by Shoreline residents too, is fairly apportioned. On the other hand, I have yet to meet someone from Shoreline who wants to make Shoreline the center of homelessness services, right? I mean, so having some of it in Seattle is okay. We don't want it all to be right in one place, right in our downtown.
And yet some of the policies of Seattle and of King County obviously will impact Shoreline pretty significantly.
Sure.
What's your take on King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg's policy of not charging for possession of heroin or meth or any other illegal substance up to a certain amount?
So... Another tough one.
You're a lawyer, so this is a perfect question for you.
And I was a deputy prosecutor for quite a while, too. And I was in the drug unit, and I prosecuted people over and over and over again for possession, and it seemed pretty pointless. And I think that's what Mr. Satterberg is trying to address. The jury is out on whether it works or whether it makes things worse, right? And that's not something I address as a city council member, and so I don't know yet. I mean, generally I support it just because I don't think the previous approaches were effective, but we may find, and we should keep an open mind, that that makes things worse rather than better, and we may have to go back to a different approach.
Well, that's something that's happening in a neighboring county, in Snohomish County. Adam Cornell, the prosecutor there, is saying, look, this policy has unintended consequences. It's hurting. And I would argue, based on the data that we have right now, that's the same thing that's going on in King County. It seems to me that if you give officers the leverage to say, hey, if you don't turn on your drug dealer, I'm going to arrest you, we're going to charge you, maybe you get some of the drug dealing off the streets. A policy that overturns what Satterberg's doing doesn't automatically mean you're going to be thrown in jail, because I don't know if a lot of people actually support that idea.
Right. And again, my experience with it, I know the old model really well, and that's exactly what we used to do. And what we ended up doing is spending a ton of money prosecuting folks and booking them to jail for very short periods of time and releasing them to go right back to being druggies again. I mean, it was simply not effective. So what I think I heard you just say is something I'd sign on to, which is you have the authority to arrest and prosecute, but the resolution of that prosecution is an assumption that it's not just jail time.
Yeah, it's a case-by-case basis. And I think that is a smarter policy just to have across the board. The other thing that obviously this dovetails into, heroin injection sites. I know that about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, that was a bigger deal for some of the races. But, you know, when you're looking down the line, especially when we're talking about a regional approach, this idea comes up again. So what's your take on heroin injection sites?
Open mind on it, but I'm skeptical. And here's why. I mean, those, no one who's sort of in the know about that talks about those as a way to get addicts off of substances. They're not effective for that. What they're effective for is not letting addicts die of an overdose. But there's not a lot of data on that. And my suspicion is if you're an organized person who takes heroin, you are going to keep yourself safe anyway. And the fact that there's a safe space for you to go isn't necessarily going to make you safer. And if you're a disorganized person, if you're a flake, you're going to still shoot up in the park and die there. You're not going to go to the safe injection site. There's an argument to be made that having those safe injection sites brings addicts into close proximity with treatment and makes it easier to get out. Again, let's see data on that. But I'm not totally opposed to them if they're effective.
Fair enough. Keith Scully is the incumbent for position number 2 on the Shoreline City Council. Jason Ranch Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM in the Greater East Side. Seahawks take on the Baltimore Ravens at home this weekend. To help preview this matchup is our friend Bob Stelton from our sister station 710 ESPN Seattle. Bob, thanks for stopping by.
You got it, ma'am.
So take us through this matchup. It comes after a pretty significant win for the Seahawks on the road.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big win, even though, as we talked about last week, I don't think the Browns are a great team. But it's still a road win, a 10 a.m. start that people freak out about. So now you're back home against a team that's got one of the more dangerous quarterbacks in the league, Lamar Jackson. He's on pace to set a record in terms of yardage through the air and yardage on the ground. He's that double threat guy like Russell, but decidedly more active when running the ball. So he presents a massive headache for any defense that's facing him. And then you look at both of these teams defensively, neither team is great. Seahawks are not a great defense. They're ranked down in the mid-20s, and that's true of the Baltimore Ravens as well. These are two teams historically that are very good defensively, so it's kind of odd that they're matching up at a time where defensively they're both struggling. They're not great defensively, but offensively they're both top 10. So this sets up, on paper anyway, to be a shootout, which means it'll be a 7-3 final.
Interesting. Okay. So take us through then what the Seahawks have to do, because, you know, your colleague Jim Moore over on ESPN basically says the same thing, that right now when you look at the Seahawks defense, they're incredibly vulnerable, and that makes them a bigger threat, even if it is at home.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's, you know, the Seahawks have given up a lot of yards. They've given up a lot of passes based on the defense they play. They tend to really tighten up when it gets down in the red zone. Fourth down, they become a much better defense. But in terms of piling up yards, they've allowed that to happen. So there are going to be opportunities for the Ravens out there. But again, I think being at home and knowing that, yeah, we kind of give up between the 20s, we'll give up a lot of yardage. But when it gets down in the red zone, they're definitely a different defense. And being at home, don't sleep on that. I mean, as much as CenturyLink Field, some people feel like it has not been the same home field advantage that's been in years past, it is still remarkably loud and can be very, very disruptive to the opposing offense.
Let's talk about the Seahawks offense. They're dealing with a number of injuries. We'll get into them in a bit, but I want to start with DJ Fluker and Duane Brown, who it seems like we're going into this weekend's matchup with them also not playing again, still injured. Is that what you're hearing?
Yeah, I mean, there have been no definitive statements made on that, but it feels like it's headed that way. And listen, Jamarco Jones has done a great job filling in for DJ Fluker, who, in my opinion, took a step back this season, mm-hmm. even before he got hurt. I didn't think he was playing great. And then he got hurt. Jamarco Jones comes in against one of the toughest matches to have as an offensive lineman going up against Aaron Donald of the Rams. They did a great job. And then did a really good job last week again. The loss of Duane Brown is much more problematic. He didn't play last week. They got away with it. They have George Fant out there. They have Joey Hunt out there playing tight end. You had a different combo working out there to sort of make do. So Duane Brown is a bigger loss. They can get by without it because, again, we just talked about the Ravens' defense is not great. So this could be a game, again, where you have fill-ins. You got guys that are backups that are going to be more than serviceable. And Jamarco Jones, in my opinion, in the 2.5 games that he's played, has played better than DJ Fluker has this year.
So we got some what we believe to be good news in the long term, not in the short term. Tight end Will Disley is definitely going to be out for some time, but not quite as long as some people anticipated. That's got to be a significant sting because of how well he's been playing.
Well, in total in two seasons, he's played 10 games. So he hasn't even yet to play a full season. And suffered a massive knee injury, patellar tendon, which is incredibly serious, and came back decidedly faster than anybody thought he would. And he's got to be the most optimistic guy I've ever encountered when it comes to these injuries, because you read what he says, you hear what he says, and it's almost odd. I mean, after the Achilles injury, he's like, hey, don't count me out. I'm going to be back before you know it. And, but rather than hanging his head and why me after all that rehab on the knee, he's incredibly optimistic. So he's shown that he can heal quickly. He can get back quickly. And he was quickly becoming Russell's second favorite target behind Tyler Lockett. I mean, he was just becoming a go-to guy who was incredibly productive. And that wasn't his reputation coming out of college. They drafted him as a blocking tight end, and that was his reputation in college. And it almost feels accidental that they figured out how good and how adept he was at catching the ball. And in a very short time, he gained the trust of Russell Wilson and became an incredibly important part of that offense.
Just joining me, we're talking with Bob Stelton from our sister station, 710 ESPN Seattle, about this weekend's matchup against the Baltimore Ravens. We only got about 2 minutes left. Let's quickly go into what this means as Earl Thomas returns to CenturyLink for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how he's received by the fans. The opposing team does not get introduced, so you're not going to have that opportunity to hear over the loudspeaker, you know, Earl Thomas, and see how people respond. Now, if he makes a play, we'll see how they respond. I would assume it'll be a pleasant greeting, if you will. I mean, he was a lot more good than he was bad for this team, and we can all focus on him, you know, flipping off the sidelines, which, you know, nobody loved that. But it was a heated moment in time. He knew his season was done. He didn't get the contract he wanted, so obviously it all came to a head in that particular moment. But he was so important to this franchise. He was so important to what they accomplished, and I think fans are aware of that. I mean, he's a beloved player. He didn't go out the way you want him to go out, but I think he's a beloved player in the city. He'll be in the Ring of Honor when his career is done.
Yep.
And we'll see who's got the advantage between him and Russell. They faced each other in practice every single day. So we're going to see who's got the advantage based on their knowledge of each other.
30 seconds left. Give us your keys to this weekend's matchup.
If the Seahawks can take advantage of what is a poor pass defense by the Ravens, then I think they're going to have a nice shot at winning this game. Ravens are very good against the run. Could be a tough day running the ball. So we'll see. As far as defensively, the Seahawks have got to figure out a way. You're not going to stop Lamar Jackson. You got to slow him down. You got to figure out a way to contain him, get the ball out of his hands, force them to run the ball. If they can do those things, they're going to win this game.
Matches on Sunday. If you want to listen to the play-by-play, listen to 710 ESPN. Seattle coverage starts at 10 a.m. Bob Stelton, thanks for stopping by. Appreciate it.
You got it, man.
You're listening to The Jason Rancher. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. Really do appreciate it. I will be filling in for Ben Shapiro next Monday and Tuesday, so make sure you listen to that.